Vicky had to go forward. There was no way back. And she forced herself to walk slowly on towards the car. At each step, a tall, robed figure stood to block her way. She knew she must show no sign of fear. Any show of weakness at all would trigger them. And she had a single brief image of her own pale body, spread-eagled upon the rocky earth, plaything for a thousand. She thrust the image firmly aside and walked on slowly. At the last possible instant, each tall figure moved aside, but there was always another beyond to take its place, and each time the throng pressed closer upon her. She could feel their heightening expectation, almost smell it in the hot musk of their packed bodies. The change in the faces were there, too. They watched her with a growing excitement, teeth grinning, breath shortening, and eyes like claws in her flesh. Suddenly, she could go no further. A figure taller and more compelling than any other blocked her path. She'd noticed this man before. He was a Gerasmach, a high gala officer. He wore a shamar of dark blue silk, wrapped about his throat and falling to his knees. His hair was fluffed out in a wide halo about the lean, cruel face, and a scar ran down from the outer corner of his eye to the point of his jaw. He said something to her in a voice that was thick with lust, and she did not understand the words, but the meaning was clear. The crowd around her stirred, and she heard the sound of their breathing and felt them press even closer towards her. A man laughed near her, and there was something so ugly in the sound that it struck her like a physical force. She wanted to scream, to turn and try and claw herself free, but she knew that was what they were waiting for. It needed just that provocation, and they would hurl themselves upon her. She gathered what was left of her reserves and put it all into her voice. "Get out of my way," she said clearly. And the man before her smiled. It was one of the most terrifying things she'd ever seen. Still smiling, he dropped one hand to his groin, opened the fold of his shamar, and made a gesture so obscene that Vicky recoiled, and she felt the scalding blood burn her throat and her cheeks. There was no control in her voice now as she blurted, "Oh, you swine, you filthy swine!" And the man reached for her, his robe still open. As she shrank back, she felt the others behind her thrust her forward again. Then another voice spoke. The words were banal, but the tone hissed like the sound of a scimitar swung at the cut. "All right, chaps, that's enough of that nonsense." Vicky felt the pressure of bodies about her ease, and she spun around with a sob catching in her throat. Gareth Swales strolled down the passage that opened for him through the dense press of robed bodies. His whole carriage seemed indolent, and the white open-necked shirt with an eye Zingari scarf at the throat was crisp and immaculate. But Vicky had never before seen the expression he wore. The rims of his nostrils were ice white, and his eyes burned with a controlled fury. She would have flung herself at him, sobbing with relief, but his voice crackled again. "Steady. We're not out yet." And she caught herself, lifted her chin, and smoothed the next sob before it escaped. "Good girl," he said, without taking his eyes from the face of the tall gala in the blue robe. And he kept on walking steadily towards him, taking Vicky's arm as he drew level with her. She felt the strength of his fingers through the thin stuff of her blouse, and it seemed to flow into her, charging her depleted reserves, and the jelly weakness in her legs firmed. The gala leader stood his ground as Gareth stepped up to him, and for a space of time that was less than 5 seconds, but seemed to Vicky like a round of eternity, the two men locked gazes and wills. Blazing blue eyes levelled with smouldering black. Then suddenly the gala broke. He glanced aside and shrugged, chuckled weakly, and turned away to talk loudly with the man who stood beside him. Unhurriedly, Gareth stepped through the gap the man had left, and they were at the car. "Are you well enough to drive?" Gareth asked quietly, as he swung her up on the sponson, and she nodded. "The engine switched off," she blurted. "They couldn't risk cranking to start." "She's on the slope," said Gareth, turning to face the crowding gallants and hold them off with his level gaze. Roller to a start. As Vicky scrambled into the driver's hatch, Gareth placed a cheroot between his lips and struck a match with his thumbnail. The little act distracted the hostile pack for an instant, and they watched his hands as he lit the cheroot and blew a long blue feather of smoke towards them. Behind him, the car began to roll, and Gareth swung himself aboard easily, with the cheroot clamped between his teeth, and gave the horseman a mocking salute as the car gathered speed down the slope. Neither of them spoke as they dropped swiftly downwards, 2 miles in silence. Then, without taking her eyes off the track ahead, Vicky told Gareth as he stood above and behind her in the turret. "You weren't even afraid. In a blue funk, old girl. Absolute blue funk. And I once called you a coward. Quite right, too. How'd you get there so fast?" "I was up there looking for defensive positions against the jolly old eye-ties. Saw your faithful bodyguard taking off. Came to have a look." The track ahead of Vicky dissolved into a mist of tears, and she had to hit the brakes hard. Afterwards, she was not quite sure how it happened, but she found herself in Gareth's arms, pressing herself to him with all of her strength and shaking violently with her sobs. "Oh, God, Gareth, I don't know what I'll ever do to repay you for this." "I'm sure we'll think of something," he murmured, holding her with a practiced embrace that was lulling and so wonderfully secure. She felt then that she did not want ever to leave his arms, and she lifted her lips to his, and with a mild amazement saw on his face, in the usually mocking blue eyes, such an expression of tenderness as she'd never expected was possible. His lips were another surprise. They were very warm and soft and tasted of man and the bitter aromatic smoke of his cheroots. She'd never realized that he was so tall and his body so hard, or his hands so strong. The last sob racked her body, and then she sighed voluptuously and shuddered softly with the strength of physical awakening more intense than she'd ever experienced in her entire life. For a moment, the journalist in her attempted to analyze the source of this sudden passion, and she knew it as the product of the previous night's sleepless horrors, of fatigue and of the day's terrors. Then she no longer queried it, but let it spread through her whole body. The encampment of the Ras's army at the foot of the Saadi Gorge sprawled for 4 miles among the acacia forests, a vast agglomeration of living things which murmured softly with life, like a hive of honeybees at midday, and which had already cloaked itself in blue wood smoke and the myriad odours of human and animal ingestion and excretion. The campsite that Gareth and Jake had chosen was set apart from the main body in a denser, shadier patch of acacia, below a tall, rocky waterfall where the Saadi River fell the last deep pitch to the plain and formed a dark, restless pool in which Vicky could bathe away the filth from her body and from her mind. It was almost dark when she climbed back to the camp, with her wet hair bound in a towel, carrying her wash bag. Gareth was seated upon a log beside the smouldering campfire. He was watching the steaks of freshly butchered ox grilling on the coals, and he made room for her on the log beside him and offered her Scotch whisky and lukewarm water in a tin mug, which she accepted gratefully, which tasted as good as anything she'd ever drunk. In silence they sat together, almost but not quite touching, and watched the swift coming of the African night. They were alone, and the faint voices from the main encampment below seemed only to emphasize this aloneness. Jake, the old Ras, and Gregorius had taken out 2 of the armored cars and a camel patrol on a reconnaissance back towards the wells of Chaldi. In the same exercise, Jake was to train the new gunners in the use of the Vickers machine guns. Gareth, as the military expert, had been left to survey the gorge and to judge the ground for defence in the event of a forced retreat up the gorge under Italian pressure. He'd been doing this when he'd come across Vicky and the Gallo horsemen. Sitting now beside the fire, under a sky that was suddenly very black and half obscured by the mountains that towered over them, Vicky was aware of a feeling of complete acceptance, an Arabic kismet of the spirit, as though fate had arranged this moment and the effort of avoiding it was too great. They were alone, and that was how it was meant to be. The deep physical arousal and feeling of utter commitment that she had experienced earlier on their escape from the threatening horde of Gallas still lingered, still filled her body and her conscious mind with an ethereal glow. She ate a little of the grilled meat, hardly tasting it, not looking at the man beside her, but staring dreamily at the brilliant diamond-white sparkle of the stars above the dark peaks, yet fully and electrically aware of him, of the nearness of him, so close that, although they were still not touching, she could feel the warmth emanating from his body upon her arm like the caress of a desert wind. She could almost feel his eyes as he watched her quietly. His gaze was so compelling that at last she could no longer pretend not to be aware of it. She turned her head and met his eyes steadily. The ruddy glow of the coals enhanced the clean, regular planes of his face and gilded the red gold of his hair. In that moment, she believed he was the most beautiful human being she'd ever seen, and it required an effort to tear her eyes away from him. As she stood up and walked away, she felt her heart hammering within her chest like a wild animal trying to escape its cage, and she heard the roar of blood in her own ears. The interior of her tent was lit softly by the firelight through the canvas, and she didn't light the lamp, but undressed slowly in the semi-darkness, dropped her clothing carelessly across the folding chair beside the entrance. Then she lay down upon the narrow cot, and the woolen blanket was rough against the naked skin of her buttocks and back. Each breath was an effort now, and she lay rigidly with her hands clenched at her side, almost afraid, almost exultant, her head propped on the single pillow and staring down at her body, aware of it as never before, watching with a sense of wonder how each breath changed the shape of her heavily rounded breasts and how the nipples firmed slowly and thrust out, darkening perceptibly, until they were so tight and hard that they pained her exquisitely. She heard the crunch of his footsteps approach the tent, and her breath jammed, and she thought with a small shock that she might suffocate and die. Then the flap of the tent swung open, and he stooped through and stood tall, letting the flap fall closed behind him. Instinctively, she covered herself, one arm folding across her chest and the other hand spreading protective fingers over the mound of fine fluff at the base of her belly. He stood silently, outlined against the fire glow of the canvas, and she began to breathe again, quick and shallow. It seemed that he stood there forever, silent and watchful, and she felt the skin of her arms and thighs prickle with goose flesh at the slow, steady scrutiny. Then he unbuttoned his shirt and let it slide to the earth. The fire glow flickered on his finely muscled arms. They rippled with a red golden sheen, like wet marble as he moved. He came at last to her bed and stood over it, and she wondered that the body of a man could be so slim and supple, with such lovely line and balance. Then she remembered how she'd once stood before the statue of Michelangelo's David, with just the same depth of awe. She lifted the hands that covered her own body, reached up like a supplicant, and drew him down upon herself. She woke once during the night, and the fire had died away outside the tent, but a bright white moon had sailed up over the mountains, and it glowed now with a silvery light through the canvas above them, striking down directly upon them. The strange white light divested Gareth's sleeping face of all colour. It was pale now, like that of a statue or of a corpse, and Vicky experienced a sudden revulsion of feeling. There was a small, dull weight at the back of her mind. When she examined it closely, she found that it was guilt, and she experienced a mild anger at a society that had burdened her with that guilt, that she could not enjoy a man, that her body could not be used as nature had intended without this backlash of emotion. She raised herself on one elbow, careful not to disturb the man beside her, and she studied his face, pondering this new sense of guilt and exploring her feelings for him. Slowly, she realized that the two were bound inextricably together. There was no real depth to her feelings for Gareth Swales. She'd been carried along on a treacherous tide of fatigue and reaction from fear and horror. The guilt she'd experienced was a consequence of this lack of substance, and she felt suddenly confused and sad. She lay back beside the long, fine length of his body, but now she'd moved slightly, so that they no longer touched. She knew that after love, all animals are sad, but she thought that there was more to her feelings than that. Suddenly, without really knowing why, she thought of Jake Barton, and the depth and cold of her sadness deepened. It was long before she slept again, but then she slept late, and the morning sunlight was striking through the canvas, and outside there was the sound of engines and many voices. She sat up hurriedly, still half asleep, clutching the rough blanket to her breast, confused and owl-eyed, to discover that she was alone upon the cot. And all that remained of the night was the indentation and warmth of Gareth's body upon the blanket beside her, and the swollen, aching feeling deep within her, where he'd been. When Vicky threw on her clothes hurriedly, and still tying her hair, went out into the sunlight, she was just in time to witness the arrival of a sorry procession. In the lead was Jake's car, Priscilla the pig, no longer glossy white and blazoned with the insignia of the International Red Cross. It was painted instead a sandy tan colour, with patches of darker camouflage, in an earthy brown, to break up the outline of the big angular hull and turret. The thick barrel of a Vickers machine gun protruded belligerently from the mounting. Above the turret fluttered the tricolored green, yellow, and red pennant of Ethiopia, and below that the dark blue field and golden lion of the Rouse's household standard, and everything was covered with a thick coating of fine red dust. Close behind the pig, and attached to her by a stout tow line, came Tenastalin, Grigoris's car, similarly daubed with dull camouflage paint, and flying the standards of Ethiopia and Ras, with her gun ports filled with lethal hardware. However, despite the warlike trappings, the machine had an air of dejection as it was dragged ignobly into the camp, and from its rear end came a frightful grinding clatter that brought Gareth Swales, hurrying half-dressed from his tent, with an angry question to shout as Jake's head appeared in the driver's hatch. "What the hell's happened?" And Jake's face was red and scowling with outrage. "That old..." And at a loss for suitable expletive, he indicated with a jerk of his thumb the Ras, who sat proudly in the turret of the crippled car, showing no remorse whatsoever, but beaming fondly and toothlessly on Gareth. Not content with firing off thousands of rounds of Vickers ammunition, he kicked Gregorius out of the driver's seat, gave us a demonstration that would have looked good at Indianapolis. "Oh, my God," groaned Gareth. "How do you do?" shouted the Rouse cheerily, acknowledging the applause. "Why didn't you stop him?" demanded Gareth. "Stop him? Jesus! You ever try to stop a charging rhinoceros? I chased him halfway to the coast before I caught him." "What's the damage?" "He stripped the gearbox, burned out the clutch. He may have thrown a conrod, but I haven't gotten up enough courage to look." Jake climbed wearily from the driver's hatch, raising his dust goggles. Red dust had sifted into the thick mop of his curls and clung in the stubble of his beard, and the protected skin around his eyes was pale and naked-looking, giving him an innocent, wide-eyed expression. He began beating the dust out of his trousers and shirt, still berating the happily grinning Ras. "The old bastard's as happy as a pig in a mud wallow. Look at his face. Reconnaissance in force. More like a bloody circus." At that moment, Jake noticed Vicky for the first time, and the scowl disappeared miraculously, to be replaced by an expression of such transparent delight that she felt her guilt return swiftly and deeply, so that it gave her a cold, sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. "Vicky!" Jake called. "God, I was worried about you." Vicky was able to purge a little of the feeling of guilt by busying herself at the cooking fire. In a fine show of domesticity, and she served the men with griddle cakes and grilled steaks, the last of the potatoes they'd brought with them, and a pan full of the pigeon-sized eggs laid by the scrawny native fowls. The camp table was set out under the acacias in the dappled early morning sunlight, and as Vicky worked at the fire, Jake reported the results of the reconnaissance. Once the Rass had tired of firing the Vickers, shooting up every tree and rock we passed, we were just about out of ammunition, we were able to circle out northwards, keeping the speed down to avoid dust, and we found a good piece of ground from which to observe the road from Massawa to the Wells. There was a bit of traffic, transports mostly, with motorized escort, but we couldn't stay too long as the Rass, God bless his friendly little soul, wanted to continue his target practice on them. We had a job stopping him. So I pulled back. We came in towards the Wells from the west again. Jake paused to sip at the mug of coffee. And Gareth turned to Vicky as she squatted, rosy-faced, over the cooking fire. "How's breakfast coming along, my dear?" he said. It was not the words, nor the endearment, but rather the proprietorial tone that made Jake glance sharply at Vicky. The tone Gareth had used was that which a man uses to his own woman. For a second, Vicky held Jake's glance, and then she turned, busily, back to her cooking, and Jake dropped his eyes thoughtfully at the steaming mug in his hands. "How close did you get?" Gareth asked easily. He'd noticed the silent exchange between Vicky and Jake, and he was relaxed and contented, lolling back in the camp chair and rolling a cheroot between his fingers. "I left the cars in the broken ground and went in on foot. Didn't want to take the Rass too close. I was able to watch the I-type position for a couple of hours. They've dug in well. I saw gun positions with a good field of fire, placed along the ridge. They're in a hell of a defensive position. It would be crazy to attack them there. We'll have to wait for them to come to us." Vicky brought the food to them, and as she leaned across Gareth, he touched her bare upper arm in a casual caress. She drew back quickly and went to fetch the pan of eggs. Jake had noticed the gesture, yet his voice was even and unruffled as he went on. "I wanted to circle out and to figure the chances of attacking their positions from the rear, but that was when the old Rass got bored, gave us a demonstration of hell driving. My God, I'm hungry." Jake filled his mouth with food, and then asked in a muffled voice, "How'd you get on, Gary?" "There's good defensive ground in the gorge. I have the construction gangs digging positions in the slopes. They should be able to give a good account if the I-tires try to force their way through." "Well, we got scouts watching them. Gregorius picked 100 of his best men for the job. We'll know as soon as they begin to move from the Wells. But I'd like to know how much time we have before they move. Every day will give us more time to prepare, decide on our tactics, and train the Harari, teach them how to fight with modern weapons." Vicky came back to the camp table and sat down. "You haven't got time," she said. "No time at all." "What's that mean?" Jake looked up. "The Italians crossed the Marib yesterday at noon. They crossed in force. They've begun bombing the towns and the roads. It's war now. It's begun." Jake whistled softly. "Hey ho, here we go," he said. I then turned to Gareth. "You'd best be the one who tells the Rass. You're the only one who can control him." "I am touched by your faith," murmured Gareth mildly. "I have a pretty good idea what the Rass's reaction will be. You want to rush straight out there and start throwing punches. He's likely to get his whole tribe wiped out. You got to calm him down." "How do you suggest I do that? Give him a shot of morphine or hit him over the head?" "Get him into a gin rummy game," suggested Jake maliciously. He scooped the last of the egg into his mouth and stood up from the table, still chewing. "Good chow, Vicky. But I reckon I better have a look at the damage the Rass did to Tenastalin. See if we can get her running again for the I-ties to shoot at." For 2 hours, Jake worked alone on tenasterlin, rigging the block and tackle from one of the main branches of the big acacia tree and loosening the bolts to lift out the entire gearbox. 20 yards away, Vicky sat at the table in front of her tent and hammered out her next dispatch on the little portable typewriter. Both of them were very much aware of each other as they worked, but their behaviour was elaborately unconcerned, and they each made a show of concentrating all their attention on their separate tasks. At last, Jake strained on the tackle, and the dismembered gearbox lifted jerkily off its seating and swayed, dripping grease from the acacia branch. Jake stood back and wiped his hands on a lump of cotton waste soaked in gasoline. "Coffee break," he said, and went to the fire. He poured 2 mugs full of black coffee and took them to where Vicky sat. "How you doing?" he asked, glancing at the page in her typewriter. "Pulitzer stuff, is it?" Vicky laughed as she accepted the mug of coffee. "Prizes never go to the best man."
"All of those who really want them," agreed Jake,
sitting down opposite her. And she felt a flare of annoyance that he'd turned the conversation so neatly. "Damn you, Jake Barton. I don't have to answer to you, or to anybody," she said softly.
"Right," he said, "quite right. You're a big girl now.
But just remember that you're playing with the big boys. And some of them play very rough."
"Is there any charge, counselor?"
She looked up at him defiantly, and then she saw the look in his eyes and the anger shriveled within her. "I don't want to fight with you, Vicky," he said softly. "That's the last thing in the world I want to do." He swallowed the last of his coffee. "Well," he said, "back to work."
"You give up easily, don't you?"
Vicky didn't realize she'd spoken until the words were out, and then she wanted them back. But Jake cocked an eye at her, and he grinned that big boyish grin of his.
"Giving up?"
Now he laughed aloud.
"Oh, lady, if you believe that, then you do me wrong. A grave injustice."
And he moved slowly towards where she sat and stood over her. The laughter faded from his voice and from his eyes as he spoke in a new husky tone.
"You really are very lovely."
"Jake," she held his eyes, "I wish I could explain. But I just don't understand myself."
He touched her cheek and stooped down to her.
"No, Jake, please don't,"
she said, and made no effort to avoid his lips. But before they touched hers, there was the urgent sound of galloping hooves coming up through the forest. The two of them drew slowly apart, still watching each other's eyes, and Gregorius Mariam rode into the camp on a shaggy little mountain pony.
"Jake!" he called, sliding down off the saddle. "It's war! It's begun! The Italians have crossed the Maghreb! Gareth has just told my grandfather!"
"The timely messenger," murmured Vicky, but her voice was a little shaky and her smile lopsided.
"I've come to help you fix my car, Jake. We must be ready to fight,"
called Gregorius, and tossed his reins to the servant who followed him.
"Let's go to work. There is little time. My grandfather has called all his commanders to a war council at noon. He wants you there."
Gregorius turned away and hurried to the gutted hulk of tenasterlin. For a moment longer, Jake stood over Vicky, and then he shrugged with resignation.
"Just remember," he threatened her mildly, "I don't give up."
And he followed Gregorius. An hour later, they'd stripped the gearbox and spread its component parts on a sheet of clean canvas. Jake rocked back on his heels.
"Well, Grandpappy has cooked his goose," he said.
And Gregorius apologized solemnly.
"He's a very impetuous gentleman, my grandfather."
"It's getting on towards noon," Jake stood up. "Let's go down, hear what next he has in store for us, that impetuous gentleman."